All right, well, thanks for having me out again. This is great. It's always nice to come back to give a talk in a place you're familiar with. So it's nice. All right, so today what I would like to do is I want to talk a little bit about what it means to study things in a Weberian kind of way, certain kinds of lessons that one might take from Weber about how one analyzes social phenomena. And the way I want to do this, which is itself a fairly Weberian way of doing this, is I want to talk about it in the abstract before I actually start applying it to anything. I want to go through a few key points of Weber's methodology that will be helpful with explicating a number of different things, and at the very end I want to turn it to talking a little bit about the two other topics that I've already mentioned, the sort of state and status kinds of questions. But mostly what I want to do in the beginning here is I just want to get out on the table, as it were, some sense of what it means to analyze things in a Weberian kind of way. And I didn't want to call it Max Weber's methodology. I wanted to talk about it as Max Weber's account, precisely because in the book that Ivor mentioned, I mean, I try to make the case there that methodology is really a term that we should reserve for thinking about research design and questions of how the mind is plugged into the world and so on. And one of the things I want to talk about in terms of Weber sort of gets at this, which is this notion of ideal typification. But then there's other parts of Weber that I think are important for analyzing things, which specifically have to do with this notion of intentions and an intentional explanation, which are not necessarily about methodology. This is the substantive point, not a methodological point. That's kind of where I want to start. I want to start talking about what an intentional explanation is, talk a little bit about ideal typification and configurations, and then come back at the end to saying how does this affect when we think about things like states and statuses. So that's kind of the roadmap for what I want to do here. In general, I think one could say, within the social sciences writ large, we have several different kinds of forms of explanation. And one form of explanation that you see an awful lot of, especially in social theory in the 20th century, runs back into certain parts of the 19th century. There's a philosophical tradition of this in the European side that goes back into the 15th and 16th centuries, is this notion of explanation by motivation, which is to say we can explain what happens in social life primarily by figuring out what's going on inside of actors, what's going on inside their heads, what's going on subjectively, what kind of decision they're making, what their thought process actually is. There's an awful lot of work out there that tries to explain things in these motivational terms. Parallel to, contrary to that kind of explanation, would be an explanation of social action which works in what we might call the intentional mode rather than the motivational mode. Action doesn't arise from something that goes on inside of heads. Action arises from a public and intersubjective process, a negotiation process, a set of ties between people, a process of meaning-making, a process by which things become comprehensible, become acceptable as options, right? Nothing in here, this is not talking about what goes on inside of heads, this is what talks about between heads, as it were. So use that as kind of a quick and dirty differentiation between different modes of explanation for just a second. This parallels the economist-sociologist distinction you run into in social theory writ large an awful lot, because often what happens is people who are interested in motivational explanations end up saying we should then specify rational interests, and we should develop models based on rational interests, and we can use those to figure out what kinds of outcomes are optimal in various ways. And what often happens to people who are interested in intentional explanation is they want to say, well, let's look at how these public processes play out in a more structural way. Let's talk about the ways in which these things combine. And so you end up with agent and structure being kind of mapped onto these two, even though those terms are very misleading and I don't really like to use them. Because I think when most people, especially within IR, but in general and not a lot of social theory, when people actually say agent explanation, what they really mean is they mean a motivational explanation. And when they say structural explanation, what they actually mean is something like an intentional explanation. And I think these are much more accurate terms for figuring out what it is. It's about the location of where the causation happens. Where is the causal process? Where is the causal mechanism? And that's what's going on in this economist-sociologist distinction that you get through a lot of social theory. Those are terms, by the way, that I pull from Brian Berry's 1970 book, Economist, Sociologist, and Democracy. Though parenthetically, when I went back and reread the book recently, I realized that my pulling of those terms from Brian Berry's book is actually very different than what Brian Berry does with them in Brian Berry's book. So I'll footnote that I got them from him, but don't expect to go back and look at what he said and find anything other than those terms informing what I'm talking about here. All right, so basic sort of distinction. So I want to expand those two for just a second. So let's think for a second about what a motivational explanation actually is. Let's go into this in a little bit more detail. When people talk about what a motive is, right, what do we mean? Well, often motive means a subjective state of mind, some sort of contents of subjective consciousness that you could hold more or less intentionally and deliberately. So we talk about beliefs. You know, I believe that this is a lecture, I believe that I'm in Norway, so on and so forth. These are things that go on, at least at the level of theory. They're supposed to sort of happen right here between your ears in some way. But other things might fit in there as motives. So expectations. If it's something that I hold subjectively and use as a basis for decision making, then it would also fit into a motivational explanation. So I can make a, I have a certain expectation about, you know, getting off the plane and my luggage being there. And that expectation causally leads me, when I'm going through the process of packing in my hotel room in London on Tuesday morning, to put certain things in my carry-on and certain things in my luggage. That expectation, it, this is a motivational explanation for why I packed certain things in particular bags, right? So that would be another form of motivational explanation. Calculations of interest work exactly the same way. Where do they occur? Calculations of interest in most of these models happen between the ears. I puzzle things out. I have my subjective utility function. I have my set of beliefs about the environment. I bring these things together. If I'm really good at it, I calculate it correctly. If I'm bad at it, or if I'm satisficing, or if I'm using some other cognitive strategy, I calculate it poorly. But in any event, it is what goes on here with my calculation that then impels me to do something. Right? This all sounds fairly obvious in a lot of ways because a lot of our explanations tend to go this way. A lot of our explanations of social life tend to become very motivational. To the extent that the external environment matters in these kinds of explanations, it matters to the extent that it is internalized. So the question of internalization or socialization, as it's often referred to, becomes really important for a motivational explanation because as Talcott Parsons once observed, if everybody is an individual calculator trying to figure out how they should do things, then you would expect chaos. Because why would anybody ever agree on anything? And so Parsons' version of this was to say, well, what happens is people end up getting socialized into the same set of beliefs and the same sets of calculations. And therefore, because they've all been socialized the same way, they've all internalized that external environment, then social life works because of that internalization process. Again, notice what's happened. The motor for explaining action is still inside the head. It's just that the inputs are coming from outside, but the motor that actually makes action happen is still going on inside. Now, contrast all of this to what we would call an intentional explanation. And this is not a distinction that Weber uses these terms to draw, but it is certainly an explanation that I think one finds very strongly in Weber's thought about social life. I'm going to, in a second after I sort of finish this distinction, I'll actually pull the passage from Weber where I think you can see this most explicitly. So an intentional explanation doesn't take place inside of heads. Where does it take place? You're not looking for something that goes on internally. We're looking for an intersubjective process, a process mostly of articulation, and in particular the articulation of meaningful action. So we talk about the performance of an identity as being relevant for the production of some kind of outcome. Not, I am giving this talk because I believe certain things about myself as a professor, but the talk itself and the form of the talk can be explained by the role that is presently being performed. The dissonance in the role that's being performed by the existence of cute baby over there, which we all keep looking at, and going, oh look, cute baby. It changes things. Why? Because there's a different set of expectations. Hard to perform the sort of really detached professor role when cute baby is looking at you. Yes, it is. See? So, performance of identity is causally... You don't need to know the subjective state of mind as to what I was thinking as I did that. It's the performance itself that is significant here. Questions of legitimation. Right? I do things, and in part we could talk about the causal process of things being done in terms of the way in which they are legitimated. Not just at the personal level, but also can happen on the collective level, can happen on the level of states. Right? States do things, perhaps, not necessarily because they believe or think anything internally, but because of ways in which certain things are legitimated, ways in which courses of action are made appropriate. So I prosecute someone at the ICC for violations of various kinds of war crimes or something. That was not an option that existed previously. So the existence of that option and the legitimacy of that option is the explanation. I don't need to know what's going on inside people's heads. I just need to know about the structure of acceptability which makes these things options that are out there, as it were. Now, where this gets really confusing is that sometimes you can talk about, you can use an intentional explanation of something that involves questions of interest without saying that the motor is somebody actually having interest. The motor in this case would be our discussion about what our interests are and ought to be. And if the causal force is located in the discussion, then we're no longer engaged in a motivational explanation, because it doesn't matter what's going on inside anybody's head. What matters is how that deliberative process plays out. So we could agree that it is in our collective interest to, you know, go have lunch someplace or whatever, and then we go out and we do that. And it's not the same as saying that we went to lunch because we each believed that we should go to lunch. So there's a difference here as to where you locate stuff. One of the interesting things about intentional explanation from an empiricist's point of view is it's a heck of a lot more tractable because you can see it. The construction of interest by sort of some kind of deliberative process leaves traces. It leaves tracks. You can actually watch it. Subjectivity, on the other hand, is awful hard to see unless you happen to be telepathic. But, you know, a lot of these other things, they actually leave empirical traces that you can actually pick up here. And when I say deliberation, I don't mean any kind of strong Habermasian notion of deliberation, which would somehow assume that, yeah, I know, I feel that way about Habermas too. You know, there's no notion here that somehow a discussion would have to be a purely rational one. Right? I mean deliberation in a much sort of broader, more rhetorical sense about things. We're exchanging various notions. It doesn't necessarily mean that we all reach some kind of rational conclusion about it. So if the idea and the important thing when we're doing a motivational explanation is about that subjective process that impels us to do things, in an intentional explanation, it's about the stabilization of contingent borders and boundaries. So debates about our identity, which are then contingently resolved among us, that contingent resolution then makes certain courses of action acceptable, certain courses of action not acceptable, and we go forth and do them. There we go. What has done the causing there? Where has the power come from? It's come from that intersubjective process, not necessarily from belief. And why this is, of course, important is when we start thinking about perhaps collective actors like states deciding what to do. And if we are really stuck in the motivational mode, then we would have to assume that everybody who's involved in the discussion ends up subjectively believing that the state should do something, as opposed to we're all part of an intersubjective negotiation process which has contingently decided that this is where we're going, and then we're sort of part of the process and we move along. I think of an article on Why Foreign Ministries Never Say Anything New, which puts the causal power squarely not in the heads of individual diplomats, but in the procedure through which what is diplomatically acceptable is negotiated among members of different bureaucracies. Right? So it's that intersubjective process that leads us to the outcome, not necessarily individual beliefs. Now, what does this have to do with our buddy Max over here? There is a very famous paragraph of Weber's, which is often misquoted. And you've probably seen this in different formats in different places. This is the famous paragraph about ideas and interests from the Economic Ethics of the World Religions. Not ideas, but material and ideal interests directly govern the actions of human beings. Yet very frequently the world images that have been created by ideas have, like switchmen, determined the tracks along which the dynamic of interest has moved such action. And you often see this misquoted because people will throw this in and say, therefore ideas matter. It's not actually what Weber says. If you really pull on the logic of this for a second, there are actually three different categories going on in this paragraph. Not two. There are three different categories, two of which are motivational and one of which is what I've called intentional. So, what are the categories? There is a category of material and a category of ideal interests. Both of those, in this conceptualization, would be subjective processes. Beliefs, calculations, all the stuff I talked about a couple of slides ago, those, according to Weber, directly govern the actions of human beings. I.e., if you want to understand why one person does one thing, then you might want to know what's going on inside of their heads. You want to know about a motive. But that only gets you to one thing. You want to understand social life, you need something else. And it is unfortunate that Weber uses the word idea. Of course, in German, it's not the same word. In English, it comes out as if idea and ideal are the same thing because of the way the roots work, but it's not actually the way it goes. Because this is really an intentional explanation. This is not about belief. This is not about a subjective process. This is about something going on intersubjectively, which guides and shapes what actually occurs within social life. So Weber is saying we have to differentiate between explanations that try to get inside and tell you what one does and explanations that actually tell us what the dynamic of the whole process, the dynamic of the whole environment within which one is located actually is. So this is where I think that this is this substantive point that I think goes on in a lot of Weberian sociology, that instead of trying to spend our time figuring out what was going on, as Charles Tilly satirizes this at one point, he says, you know, this is an incredible amount of work required to figure out what somebody's state of mind was the moment before they did something. And if you could do all of that, the bet seems to be, then you could sort of figure out what was going on. But Tilly points out, it takes an inordinate amount of effort to figure out what somebody else is thinking. It takes an inordinate amount of effort to figure out what you're thinking the moment before you act. And how many times do you go back and re-narrate what you did after you did it? Or did you have conflicting notions going on at the same time? It wasn't altogether clear why you did what you did, but then one of them emerges as the story afterwards because it's the one that seems to fit best. Now multiply that problem by how many billions of people are there in the world? And Tilly points out, this is just not worth it. Even if you could figure all of that stuff out, the amount of effort it would take you would mean that you would never actually be able to explain anything. And Weber, I think, points us to the way out. What we should be looking for here are these broader kinds of intersubjective negotiation processes whereby courses of action become acceptable, whereby things become possible. There is a way that this sort of intentional explanation is always wrapped up with what one might call a condition of possibility. Simply saying that there are courses of action available does not mean that any one in particular will actually be followed. It just means certain things become possible, conceivable, thinkable, right? So they're out there and there's different things that could actually be said. The way that a linguistic grammar works, grammar doesn't make you say stuff, but it does make it possible for you to say things. So that's that realm that I think Weber is trying to call attention to. Now, in order to really, though, make sense of what's going on in this, we need this other part of what it means to do a Weberian account of something, which is where we have to think for a second about ideal typification. Because this distinction that I've drawn so far between motives and intentions, what usually people will say or think at this point is, all right, but how could you do an intentional explanation of something? Because don't people have motives? Don't people have things going on inside their heads? And how could you ignore that? That's usually the kind of objection that gets raised here. And that objection gets raised because people don't take seriously enough the fact that for Weber, explanations work with ideal types, not with empirical descriptions. And I want to say a little bit about that so we can really kind of grasp what that means. Think for a moment about the difference if you're explaining a particular kind of public policy outcome. Right? Motivational explanation, you're trying to find out what it is that people thought. And an intentional explanation, you're looking at that intersubjective negotiation process. When you're doing this, you're not denying that people thought things. You're not denying that people might have been motivated by things. No, you're not, really. And by doing so, you're not making a fundamental ontological claim. You are instead making an analytical claim, which is to say, you are wagering, to use a term that I use in my book, you are wagering that you can create a good enough explanation of the outcome in question without a strong specification of the subjective contents of anybody's heads. It's an analytical wager, and it can only be demonstrated in practice. It can only be demonstrated by taking that, developing a set of tools and models from it, and then running them through some empirical cases and seeing whether it actually allows you to explain stuff. This whole not making a fundamental ontological claim but making an analytical one is this procedure that Weber refers to as ideal typification. And methodologically speaking, if we want to use that term in its more narrow sense for a second, the sense that I mentioned at the beginning is why I didn't call the whole lecture about, I didn't call the entire thing methodology. The ideal types is a, this is the methodological part of it. This is about how one designs one's research, because an ideal type is a very interesting thing. It's a deliberate oversimplification. There's a bit in here about reality being, in some sense, too complex for us to ever grasp in its entirety. It is kind of an anti-totalizing way of thinking about knowledge. There's no way to exhaustively get everything. And instead of that, we operate, Weber suggests, necessarily operate with ideal types. We always end up oversimplifying a very complex reality. And in particular, we always oversimplify it for the purpose of highlighting certain things within it. Weber gives this really interesting example in the ideal typification essay in the essay on the quote-unquote objectivity of the social sciences, the 1904 piece. He gives this great example, and he says the economicness, the extent to which the medieval polity has an economic component, is a not something that you can read right off the data. It's something that you have to bring in. We're sensitive to this because we think economic factors are important. So that's why we see that the analysis of the medieval polity has an economic component. And this is even more shocking when you realize that what he was writing was an editorial statement for a journal of political economy. And he says, no, you know, the economicness of it is actually... The economicness of it is precisely something that that we bring to it. It is of interest to us and not necessarily of interest to other people. Okay, and if we perhaps could have the projector work again, that way, oh, look at that. Excellent. So, if you take ideal typification seriously, it means there's no such thing as a pure description. There's no such thing as a complete description. That to use words, if we want to push this maybe one step further than Weber does, but I think it's sort of what he implies, that even the use of generic nouns is itself a form of ideal typification. You know, to use the hackneyed example that you always get in these discussions, table, right? There's lots of different kinds of tables. If you are a Platonist, then you think it's because there's a real ideal form of the table out there someplace to which these all approximate. If you are a Weberian, you say, no. The word table itself is an ideal type. It is a way of isolating certain features about this object that we find important and bear what Wittgenstein would call a family resemblance with other things to which we similarly apply the word. So it's a very anti-utopian, anti-idealistic way of thinking about language. To say that we really engage in these sorts of ideal typification processes whenever we're even describing things, let alone explaining them. We're always isolating particular things. These are not ideals. An ideal type is not an ideal. You can ideal typify something you find morally reprehensible. You know, you can have ideal typical notions of suicide bombing. You can have ideal typical fundamentalist predictions of the end of the world, which turn out to be false in practice. But hey, you know, made for some good parties in the United States while people were worried about Judgment Day coming on Saturday. You know, they're not ideals, but they are, in a sense, what Weber calls utopian. An ideal type, because it is necessarily oversimplified, takes a phenomenon and pushes it to its logical extreme. So, it doesn't make it desirable, but it does make it logically pure. That's one of the things that's important about an ideal type. And the other thing that's important, though, about an ideal type is it's not just a pure type. An ideal type is not just a logical construct. It is that, but it's a little more than that, too. An ideal type, in addition to being both abstract and idealized, and the distinction there is that for something to be abstract means that it isolates it, and for something to be idealized means it makes unrealistic assumptions. Think about the ideal gas law, for instance, in physics, which makes a set of assumptions about gases which are inherently unrealistic, but it's still pretty useful for calculating stuff. Right, so that's kind of where that notion comes from. An ideal type is not a pure type. It's not just a logical abstraction. Precisely because in order to figure out what you're going to idealize, you have to be rooted in a particular cultural context. Different people, different perspectives on objects are going to end up with different kinds of ideal types. Back to Weber's point about the economy. If we weren't so darn concerned about economic factors, we would not look back at the history of medieval Europe and see a set of economic things. We might look back and see other things. And Weber says, that's perfectly okay, because every account is ideal typical, and every account is rooted in its local cultural context. So, this is the diagram that I think is kind of interesting. This is I wrote this up when I was doing the book as a way of trying to graphically illustrate what goes on when you ideal typify some phenomenon. So, the production of an ideal type turns out to be a really complicated process that has 7 steps. And, yes, this is an ideal type of ideal typification. Haha, we could talk about the meta-ness of it a little bit later. But the way I've got this put up here, you start off to do an ideal type with the researcher being located somewhere specifically, culturally, within a sphere of values. You are located in a place. Right? Classical notions of objectivity were that you could view from nowhere, you could look without any kind of presuppositions. Ideal typification just drives a stake right through the heart of that and says, no, you can't do that. You're always looking from somewhere. So you need to know where you are in terms of figuring out what your ideal type is going to be. So the first thing you do is you are explicitly or implicitly, and Weber would say it should be more explicit, and I would agree, you are taking a stand on certain kinds of values. You are taking a stand within your local environment. That is a part of ideal typification, knowing where you are and where you begin. That stand-taking then gives you what Weber refers to as value commitments. There are certain things that I find important. I've now articulated that I find them important. All of this stuff here before B, all of this is the kind of thing that just takes place when researchers and research communities sort of discuss stuff, but those things themselves are not open to, shall we say, empirical verification or testing, because this is not in the sphere of empirics yet. This is all in the sphere of thinking about values and where we stand. So, once we've got a set of value commitments, when we actually move to producing our ideal type, what we need to do is, in a sense, we need to formalize what those value commitments are like. So suppose I am committed to a certain understanding of democracy. I have certain things that I think fit within a notion of democracy. But in order for me to actually take those things out on the road, take them from just being a value commitment to an actually useful analytical tool, I have to formalize what I mean. I have to come up with some sort of an operational definition for what these things are. So I formalize what those value commitments are a little bit. And if I'm a game theorist, I formalize them a lot. And if I'm more of a qualitative theorist, then I formalize them a little because I define them. But in any case, I'm still formalizing them to some extent. That then leads us to an analytical depiction of particular situations in terms of those notions. So I have a particular ideal type of democracy, I've formalized it, I took that, and that gives me a certain kind of analytical depiction of what an ideal typical democracy looks like. This is taking place in abstract logical space. Now, I may have come up with this by researching an awful lot of historical stuff, but as I'm doing the analytical depiction, the depiction itself is not taking place in history, right? The depiction is taking place in this research space where I've got something that's kind of abstractly and artificially pure. Then, of course, because what I want to do, one of the things Weber reminds us of all the time, ideal types are not ends in themselves. They are means for helping us make sense out of individual cases. So after I've got my analytical depiction, I have to apply it. I have to take my analytical depiction, I've got to take it out into the world, and I've got to see what it shows me that I wouldn't see otherwise. Now, this is a step people often get wrong because they think that then you take the ideal type and you take it out into the world, you take an ideal type of it like a Weberian bureaucracy and you look at a real bureaucracy and you hold up what Weber says about bureaucracy to an actual bureaucracy and you say, you know what, Weber was wrong about bureaucracy. Okay, that's not the point. In many ways, the divergence between the world and the ideal type is precisely the finding. That's actually what you're looking for. People do this in IR wrong all the time. They take Ken Waltz's theory about balancing and they say, look, states don't balance as much as Waltz predicts, and therefore Waltz is wrong. No, that's not the point. See? It's not the point. Waltz sets a set of expectations. When the world diverges from the set of expectations, that shows you what you need to explain. That shows you what is interesting. That actually shows you what is of interest in the particular case. The application of an ideal type, and I want to talk a little bit more about that in just a second. The application of ideal type to the complex empirical world is what produces facts. Facts, not value judgments. Value judgment, baby is cute. Facts are something different, right? You see how far facts are from values. You see how far facts are from values, right? When people talk misleadingly about Weber thinking that facts and values are two totally different things, I'd like to show them this. Facts for Weber are value dependent, but they're not just value statements. Right? To have a fact, if you are Weber or a Weberian, is to have a value-laden perspective on the actual complex world. The application of that perspective is what gives you facts, but your facts are something different than simply statements of your value orientation. That is what Weber thought the value added of social science was. The value added of social science was forcing people to be precise enough about their value commitments that we would no longer just hurl value commitments at each other, but we would then have a very different kind of discussion, which is, okay, you have your value commitments and I have mine, and we've applied them to these cases and we've gotten some different things. Now let's talk about what we got. Let's talk about the applications and the results. And let's not worry about the value commitments, because you know what? My gods and your gods probably don't get along all that well. And that's okay, unless we want to have a religious war. If we don't have a religious war and we actually want to have a discussion about something, let's agree that you have your gods and I have my gods, and, you know, as Weber says, we live in a polytheistic universe. This is parenthetically the other difference with Habermas. If you're Habermas, you can just talk these things out and then have a rational reconciliation, and then everybody believes in the same, well, it wouldn't be God if you're Habermas, but everybody believes in reason or something, or speech or something like that. For Weber, this is a very different way of dealing with this problem. Right? But it is definitely not the case that values and facts have nothing to do with each other. There's just a very specific procedure through which you derive them. And then when you take these things out into the world, I said a second ago that you don't take them out there to try to falsify them or test them. So what do you actually do? What do you actually do with them? Well, what you actually do with an ideal type, take it out into the world, and you end up producing a configurational explanation. And the reason you end up producing a configurational explanation is because these two very important things about ideal types that lead to the idea that all explanations have to be configurational. One of them, of course, is that there's a necessary incompleteness. No ideal type is equal to the thing that it is ideal typifying, or the relationship that it is ideal typifying, or whatever. Because ideal types are necessarily incomplete, that probably means that there's a possibility for more than one of them to be utilized to help figure out what's going on in a given situation. So ideal types are always less than, in some sense, the complexity of the issue. So that means you're always going to have more than one of them floating around. And because ideal types are a means to figure out what's going on in individual cases, Weber's very, very skeptical of general laws. He's very skeptical of general laws, pointing out that, in fact, most of what we're interested in when we study social life are individual instances. Laws are only useful to us in as much as they give us expectations against which individual instances look interesting. And so, focusing on a single case with necessarily incomplete ideal types means that an explanation will more likely than not involve some way of thinking about tensions between different kinds of ideal types and how those tensions actually play out in practice. So I think, for instance, about, in IR terms, I think about Ken Waltz, right? So Waltz gives us an ideal type of how balancing is supposed to occur at the international level. And if we were to take Waltz's ideal type and we were then to lay it down in individual cases and say, well, there's other pressures that are pushing in different directions, let's ideal typify some of those. So let's think about domestic politics. Let's think about domestic, seeking approval from different kinds of domestic constituencies. Think about that as being a different kind of pressure on a particular leader. Then, what's interesting is looking in a single case, how is it that those tensions actually get played out by concrete individuals and groups that are located at the intersection of those ideal types? That becomes the interesting configurational question. How do these tensions get provisionally resolved in practice? The ideal type is what tells us what's interesting. Right? The ideal type allows you to identify these different kinds of causal factors. And what Weber refers to them as, and he's not entirely consistent in this usage, but I think you can sort of extract this from especially this one essay on the historical logic of the social sciences. He talks about different kinds of factors. He talks about things in a case that are adequately causal, coincidentally causal, and incidental. Something is adequately causal to the extent that you cannot imagine things having worked out the way they did if you moved that factor. And that thing is part of one of the ideal types that you're utilizing for a particular situation. So, ideal types allow you to figure out what's adequately causal because they sort of show you what's important and they discipline your imagination in terms of what possible outcomes might be. Things that are coincidentally causal are things that are not part of a systematic ideal type but are still important to a given situation. So, we could say that it matters a lot that let's think of a good example of something that's nicely coincidentally causal. It matters a lot that George W. Bush was a certain kind of Christian articulated himself as a certain kind of Christian in terms of the way he articulated his foreign policy. And that may not be part of a systematic ideal type, but we can say it's coincidentally causal because it's really hard to imagine somebody who didn't articulate themselves in that way conducting the same kind of foreign policy. So you go, okay, so that may be coincidentally caused. And the things that are incidental, you can modify those imaginatively and it doesn't change the outcome. The stress in all of these things for Weber is on this disciplined process of counterfactual imagination. So you know something's important if you have a hard time imagining the world without it. And Weber's very clear that this is an imaginative process, but it's a disciplined imaginative process. And if you play this logic out a little bit, when people are actually engaged in abstract modeling exercises and they're trying to forecast things, what they're really doing is they're trying to imagine possible worlds. That's actually what models do. It's what they're for. We mistake this all the time because we think they're testable. They're not. They're a forecast which allows you to sort of see what would the world be like. And then you get to the end of it and go, I don't really buy that. Okay, what does that tell me? Well, it tells me something interesting about which factors I threw in at which point in the model. So the operation is just a way of disciplining your imagination when it comes to these things. So it's all about the scholarly imagination and the scholarly community debating these things. That's sort of what ideal types are actually useful for. Now, you find this stuff in a lot of different places within IR. I'm just going to throw this up because you end up with a lot of international relations theories being very motive-oriented, and you end up with not very many of them being particularly intent-oriented. Some of them are. I couldn't put up here a set of points about ideal typical versus non-ideal typical ways of doing things because almost nobody in IR actually does ideal typical work. For the most part, people think that these things are hypotheses. So what you end up with, if you wanted to do a 2x2, which would of course make it social science, then you would end up saying that most IR work is both motivational and non-ideal typical. Most IR scholarship, I think, fits there. The box that I think is in some ways the most interesting, of course, is the intent and ideal typification box. And the two, as I suggested earlier in the talk, are related because the notion of intentional explanation doesn't make much sense unless you adopt something like ideal typification. Otherwise, this becomes an ontological claim. And I think this makes no sense as an ontological claim. But it makes a great deal of sense as an analytical claim. Now, what does this do to the two topics that we actually had at the beginning? And by the beginning, I mean the beginning title for the talk that actually was supposed to be the title of the talk, so the state and status, and I don't have a nice slide on this. But I will say a couple of things here at the end about what I think this does for us. I think that if we conjoin ideal typification and intentional explanation, I think if you use that as an orientation for thinking about states, you would end up with a couple of things. First of all, you would end up with a way of analyzing state action that did not concern itself with trying to identify what the real interests of the state were. And you would end up with a way of thinking about state action that would put much more store in public performances of state identity than in other things. Even if those performances of state identity took place sort of behind closed doors, we're losing our mascot. Even if those performances take place sort of behind closed doors, the fact that they're still being performed in a particularly small public are significant. So rhetoric about identity becomes really significant when it comes to thinking about state action. Rhetoric about and efforts to legitimate state rule become very, very significant. How do the various things that are attributed to the state get attributed to the state as something it's supposed to have the right to do? That becomes a really important question if we try to analyze it in these terms. And the famous Weberian ideal type of the state as the association that a human community that manages to successfully uphold the legitimate right to use force in a given territory. If we think about that as an ideal type and not as a falsifiable proposition, then that becomes a particular way of thinking about how political authority plays out in different spots around the world. Does it look like that? Does it go in different kinds of ways? What would this ideal type give us in terms of legitimating rhetorics that would work for different things and not for others? So it would give us an explanation in terms of public performance, and it would give us an explanation in terms of institutional variation. And if you apply it to notions of status, then I think what you would end up with is the idea that a model of a status hierarchy would be an ideal type, right? Would not necessarily be an empirical description of where people are, but it would be an ideal, typical understanding of status groups and how things fit together. Think about it in terms of the international system. Great powers and middle powers and peripheral powers and so on would not be, as world systems theorists might want to do, a question of measuring the economic productivity of different regions of the globe. But it would instead be a way of looking at the social statuses and the languages about status that are being utilized diplomatically and where things are actually being configured. You would say, what kind of ideal type of map of the world can we derive from all of this communication? So what does this kind of look like? So that's what it would give us ideal typically. And the fact that it's intentional would mean that we would not be particularly interested in questions of whether anybody believed this stuff, but we would be interested in more of the functional question. What does it do? What does that kind of status language do? What happens when notions of status are deployed to shut down various kinds of things? Or, you know, think about some of the language that the U.S. uses to build coalitions of the willing. You are a particular kind of state. You are in this category, right? That means you've got to help us, right? 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 So that process is going on intersubjectively. There's a way in which status is used as a causal element of being able to put together these kinds of coalitions. It would be using the status hierarchy as not the object of explanation, but as an element of an explanation for some particular kind of action. It would be using these kinds of abstract delineations and these abstract notions of systems and actors, not as ends in themselves, but as means to try to explicate what, in Weber's terms, or as Weber might say, and as I would agree with, what we actually ought to be explaining in social life, which is particular events, particular occurrences, particular actions. Those are the things we ought to be trying to explain. We explain them with this equipment of ideal types and intentions. But those are all means to try to get us down to the specific end, which is explaining very, very specific and concrete stuff. And I think stuff is a good word to stop on, so I'm going to stop at the word stuff.